dare to let him see her. The fact that he did not, as she had feared, order her to be carried away by force, but only told her not to let him see her, cheered Princess Maria. She knew it was a proof that in the depth of his soul he was glad she was remaining at home and had not gone away. The morning after little Nikolai had left, the old prince donned his full uniform and prepared to visit the commander-in-chief. His calèche was already at the door. Princess Maria saw him walk out of the house in his uniform, wearing all his orders, and go down the garden to review his armed peasants and domestic serfs. She sat by the window, listening to his voice, which reached her from the garden. Suddenly, several men came running up the avenue with frightened faces. Princess Maria ran out to the porch, down the flower-bordered path and into the avenue. A large crowd of militiamen and domestics were moving toward her, and in their midst several men were supporting by the armpits and dragging along a little old man in a uniform and decorations. She ran up to him, and in the play of the sunlight that fell in small round spots through the shade of the lime tree avenue, could not be sure what change there was in his face. All she could see was that his former stern and determined expression had altered to one of timidity and submission. On seeing his daughter, he moved his helpless lips and made a hoarse sound. It was impossible to make out what he wanted. He was lifted up, carried to his study, and laid on the very couch she had so feared of late. The doctor, who was fetched that same night, bled him and said that the prince had had a seizure paralysing his right side. It was becoming more and more dangerous to remain at Bald Hills, and next day they moved the prince to Bogucharova, the doctor accompanying him. By the time they reached Bogucharova, Dessalles and the little prince had already left for Moscow. For 3 weeks the old prince lay stricken by paralysis in the new house Prince Andrei had built at Bogucharova, ever in the same state, getting neither better nor worse. He was unconscious and lay like a distorted corpse. He muttered unceasingly, his eyebrows and lips twitching, and it was impossible to tell whether he understood what was going on around him or not. One thing was certain, that he was suffering and wished to say something. But what it was, no one could tell. It might be some caprice of a sick and half-crazy man, or it might relate to public affairs, or possibly to family concerns. The doctor said this restlessness did not mean anything and was due to physical causes, but Princess Maria thought he wished to tell her something, and the fact that her presence always increased his restlessness confirmed her opinion. He was evidently suffering both physically and mentally. There was no hope of recovery. It was impossible for him to travel. It would not do to let him die on the road. Would it not be better if the end did come, the very end? Princess Maria sometimes thought. Night and day, hardly sleeping at all, she watched him and, terrible to say, often watched him not with hope of finding signs of improvement, but wishing to find symptoms of the approach of the end. Strange as it was to acknowledge this feeling in herself, yet there it was. And what seemed still more terrible to her was that since her father's illness began, perhaps even sooner, when she stayed with him expecting something to happen, all the personal desires and hopes that had been forgotten or sleeping within her had awakened. Thoughts that had not entered her mind for years, thoughts of a life free from the fear of her father, and even the possibility of love and of family happiness, floated continually in her imagination like temptations of the devil. Thrust them aside as she would, questions continually recurred to her as to how she would order her life now after that. These were temptations of the devil, and Princess Maria knew it. She knew that the sole weapon against him was prayer, and she tried to pray. She assumed an attitude of prayer, looked at the icons, repeated the words of a prayer, but she could not pray. She felt that a different world had now taken possession of her, the life of a world of strenuous and free activity, quite opposed to the spiritual world in which till now she had been confined, and in which her greatest comfort had been prayer. She could not pray, could not weep, and worldly cares took possession of her. It was becoming dangerous to remain in Boguchárovo. News of the approach of the French came from all sides, and in one village, 10 miles from Boguchárovo, a homestead had been looted by French marauders. The doctor insisted on the necessity of moving the prince. The provincial marshal of the nobility sent an official to Princess Maria to persuade her to get away as quickly as possible, and the head of the rural police, having come to Boguchárovo, urged the same thing, saying that the French were only some 25 miles away, that French proclamations were circulating in the villages, and that if the princess did not take her father away before the 15th, he could not answer for the consequences. The princess decided to leave on the 15th. The cares of preparation and giving orders for which everyone came to her occupied her all day. She spent the night of the 14th as usual without undressing in the room next to the one where the prince lay. Several times waking up, she heard his groans and muttering, the creak of his bed and the steps of Tichon and the doctor when they turned him over. Several times she listened at the door, and it seemed to her that his mutterings were louder than usual and that they turned him over oftener. She could not sleep, and several times went to the door and listened, wishing to enter but not deciding to do so. Though he did not speak, Princess Maria saw and knew how unpleasant every sign of anxiety on his account was to him. She had noticed with what dissatisfaction he turned from the look she sometimes involuntarily fixed on him. She knew that her going in during the night at an unusual hour would irritate him. But never had she felt so grieved for him, or so much afraid of losing him. She recalled all her life with him, and in every word and act of his found an expression of his love of her. Occasionally, amid these memories, temptations of the devil would surge into her imagination, thoughts of how things would be after his death, and how her new, liberated life would be ordered. But she drove these thoughts away with disgust. Toward morning, he became quiet, and she fell asleep. She woke late. That sincerity which often comes with waking showed her clearly what chiefly concerned her about her father's illness. On waking, she listened to what was going on behind the door, and hearing him groan, said to herself with a sigh that things were still the same. But what could have happened? What did I want? I want his death, she cried with a feeling of loathing for herself. She washed, dressed, said her prayers, and went out to the porch. In front of it stood carriages without horses, and things were being packed into the vehicles. It was a warm, grey morning. Princess Maria stopped at the porch, still horrified by her spiritual baseness, and trying to arrange her thoughts before going to her father. The doctor came downstairs and went out to her. "He is a little better today," said he. "I was looking for you. One can make out something of what he's saying. His head is clearer. Come in. He is asking for you." Princess Maria's heart beat so violently at this news that she grew pale and leaned against the wall to keep from falling. To see him, talk to him, feel his eyes on her now that her whole soul was overflowing with those dreadful, wicked temptations, was a torment of joy and terror. "Come," said the doctor. Princess Maria entered her father's room and went up to his bed. He was lying on his back, propped up high, and his small, bony hands with their knotted purple veins were lying on the quilt. His left eye gazed straight before him, his right eye was awry, and his brows and lips motionless. He seemed altogether so thin, small, and pathetic. His face seemed to have shriveled or melted. His features had grown smaller. Princess Maria went up and kissed his hand. His left hand pressed hers so that she understood that he had long been waiting for her to come. He twitched her hand, and his brows and lips quivered angrily. She looked at him in dismay, trying to guess what he wanted of her. When she changed her position so that his left eye could see her face, he calmed down, not taking his eyes off her for some seconds. Then his lips and tongue moved, sounds came, and he began to speak, gazing timidly and imploringly at her, evidently afraid that she might not understand. Straining all her faculties, Princess Maria looked at him. The comic efforts with which he moved his tongue made her drop her eyes, and with difficulty repress the sobs that rose to her throat. He said something, repeating the same words several times. She could not understand them, but tried to guess what he was saying, and inquiringly repeated the words he uttered. He repeated several times. It was quite impossible to understand these sounds. The doctor thought he had guessed them, and inquiringly repeated, "Maria, are you afraid?" The prince shook his head, again repeated the same sounds. My mind aches?" questioned Princess Maria. He made a mumbling sound in confirmation of this, took her hand, and began pressing it to different parts of his breast, as if trying to find the right place for it.
"Always thoughts about you. Thoughts,"
he then uttered much more clearly than he had done before, now that he was sure of being understood. Princess Maria pressed her head against his hand, trying to hide her sobs and tears. He moved his hand over her hair.
"I have been calling you all night," he brought out. "Oh, if only I had known," she said through her tears. "I was afraid to come in."
He pressed her hand.
"Weren't you asleep?"
"No, I did not sleep," said Princess Maria, shaking her head.
Unconsciously imitating her father, she now tried to express herself as he did, as much as possible by signs, and her tongue too seemed to move with difficulty.
"Dear one, dearest,"
Princess Maria could not quite make out what he had said, but from his look it was clear that he had uttered a tender, caressing word, such as he had never used to her before.
"Why didn't you come in?"
"And I was wishing for his death," thought Princess Maria.
He was silent a while.
"Thank you, daughter dear, forgive, thank you.
And tears began to flow from his eyes.
"Call André,"
he said suddenly, and a childish, timid expression of doubt showed itself on his face as he spoke. He himself seemed aware that his demand was meaningless, so at least it seemed to Princess Maria.
"I have a letter from him," she replied.
He glanced at her with timid surprise.
"Where is he?"
"He's with the army, father, at Smolensk."
He closed his eyes and remained silent a long time. Then, as if in answer to his doubts, and to confirm the fact that now he understood and remembered everything, he nodded his head and reopened his eyes.
"Yes,"
he said, softly and distinctly.
"Russia has perished. They've destroyed her."
And he began to sob, and again tears flowed from his eyes. Princess Maria could no longer restrain herself and wept while she gazed at his face. Again he closed his eyes. His sobs ceased, and he pointed to his eyes, and Tikhon, understanding him, wiped away the tears. Then he again opened his eyes and said something none of them could understand for a long time, till at last Tikhon understood and repeated it. Princess Maria had sought the meaning of his words in the mood in which he had just been speaking. She thought he was speaking of Russia, or Prince Andrei, of herself, of his grandson, or of his own death, and so she could not guess his words.
"Put on your white dress. I like it,"
was what he said. Having understood this, Princess Maria sobbed still louder, and the doctor, taking her arm, led her out to the veranda, soothing her and trying to persuade her to prepare for her journey. When she had left the room, the prince again began speaking about his son, about the war, and about the emperor, angrily twitching his brows and raising his hoarse voice. And then he had a second and final stroke. Princess Maria stayed on the veranda. The day had cleared. It was hot and sunny. She could understand nothing, think of nothing, and feel nothing, except passionate love for her father, love such as she thought she had never felt till that moment. She ran out sobbing into the garden and as far as the pond, along the avenues of young lime trees Prince Andrei had planted.
"Yes, I wished for his death, yes. I wanted it to end quicker. I wished to be at peace. And what will become of me? What use will peace be when he is no longer here?"
Princess Maria murmured, pacing the garden with hurried steps and pressing her hand to her bosom, which heaved with convulsive sobs. When she had completed the tour of the garden, which brought her again to the house, she saw Mademoiselle Bourienne, who had remained at Boguchárovo and did not wish to leave it, coming toward her with a stranger. This was the marshal of the nobility of the district, who had come personally to point out to the princess the necessity for her prompt departure. Princess Maria listened without understanding him. She led him to the house, offered him lunch, and sat down with him. Then, excusing herself, she went to the door of the old prince's room. The doctor came out with an agitated face and said she could not enter. "Go away, princess! Go away! Go away!" She returned to the garden and sat down on the grass at the foot of the slope by the pond, where no one could see her. She did not know how long she had been there when she was aroused by the sound of a woman's footsteps running along the path. She rose and saw Dunyasha, her maid, who was evidently looking for her, and who stopped suddenly as if in alarm on seeing her mistress.
"Please come, princess, the prince," said Dunyasha in a breaking voice.
"Immediately. I'm coming," replied the princess hurriedly,
not giving Dunyasha the time to finish what she was saying, and trying to avoid seeing the girl, she ran toward the house.
"Princess, it's God's will. You must be prepared for everything," said the marshal, meeting her at the house door.
"Let me alone! It's not true!"
she cried angrily to him. The doctor tried to stop her. She pushed him aside and ran to her father's door.
"Why are these people with frightened faces stopping me? I don't want any of them. And what are they doing here?" she thought.
She opened the door, and the bright daylight in that previously darkened room startled her. In the room were her nurse and other women. They all drew back from the bed, making way for her. He was still lying on the bed as before, but the stern expression of his quiet face made Princess Maria stop short on the threshold.
"No, he's not dead. It's impossible," she told herself,
and approached him, and repressing the terror that seized her, she pressed her lips to his cheek, but she stepped back immediately. All the force of the tenderness she had been feeling for him vanished instantly and was replaced by a feeling of horror at what lay there before her.
"No, he is no more. He is not. But here, where he was, is something unfamiliar and hostile, some dreadful, terrifying, and repellent mystery."
And hiding her face in her hands, Princess Maria sank into the arms of the doctor, who held her up. In the presence of Tichon and the doctor, the women washed what had been the prince, tied his head up with a handkerchief so that the mouth should not stiffen while open, and with another handkerchief tied together the legs that were already spreading apart. Then they dressed him in uniform with his decorations and placed his shriveled little body on a table. Heaven only knows who arranged all this and when, but it all got done,
as if of its own accord.
Toward night, candles were burning round his coffin, a pall was spread over it, the floor was strewn with sprays of juniper, a printed band was tucked in under his shrivelled head, and in a corner of the room sat a chanter reading the Psalms. Just as horses shy and snort and gather about a dead horse, so the inmates of the house and strangers crowded into the drawing-room round the coffin, the marshal, the village elder, peasant women, and all with fixed and frightened eyes, crossing themselves, bowed and kissed the old prince's cold and stiffened hand. Chapter 9. The Rebellious Mood of the Bogucharova Peasants. Until Prince Andrei settled in Bogucharova, its owners had always been absentees, and its peasants were of quite a different character from those of Bald Hills. They differed from them in speech, dress, and disposition. They were called steppe peasants. The old prince used to approve of them for their endurance at work when they came to Bald Hills to help with the harvest or to dig ponds and ditches, but he disliked them for their boorishness. Prince Andrei's last stay at Bogucharova, when he introduced hospitals and schools and reduced the quit rent the peasants had to pay, had not softened their disposition, but had on the contrary strengthened in them the traits of character the old prince called boorishness. Various obscure rumours were always current among them. At one time a rumour that they would all be enrolled as Cossacks, at another of a new religion to which they were all to be converted, then of some proclamation of the Tsar's and of an oath to the Tsar Paul in 1797, in connection with which it was rumoured that freedom had been granted them, but the landowners had stopped it. Then of Pyotr Fyodorovich's return to the throne in 7 years' time, when everything would be made free and so simple that there would be no restrictions. Rumours of the war with Bonaparte and his invasion were connected in their minds with the same sort of vague notions of Antichrist, the end of the world, and pure freedom. In the vicinity of Bogucharova were large villages belonging to the crown or to owners whose serfs paid quit-rent and could work where they pleased. There were very few resident landlords in the neighbourhood, and also very few domestic or literate serfs, and in the lives of the peasantry of those parts, the mysterious undercurrents in the life of the Russian people, the causes and meaning of which are so baffling to contemporaries, were more clearly and strongly noticeable than among others. One instance, which had occurred some 20 years before, was a movement among the peasants to emigrate to some unknown warm rivers. Hundreds of peasants, among them the Bogucharova folk, suddenly began selling their cattle and moving in whole families toward the southeast. As birds migrate to somewhere beyond the sea, so these men with their wives and children streamed to the southeast to parts where none of them had ever been. They set off in caravans, bought their freedom one by one or ran away, and drove or walked toward the warm rivers. Many of them were punished, some sent to Siberia, many died of cold and hunger on the road, many returned of their own accord, and the movement died down of itself just as it had sprung up, without apparent reason. But such undercurrents still existed among the people, and gathered new forces ready to manifest themselves just as strangely, unexpectedly, and at the same time simply, naturally, and forcibly. Now, in 1812, to anyone living in close touch with these people, it was apparent that these undercurrents were acting strongly and nearing an eruption. Alpátych, who had reached Bogucharova shortly before the old prince's death, noticed an agitation among the peasants, and that contrary to what was happening in the Bald Hills district, where in a radius of over 40 miles all the peasants were moving away and leaving their villages to be devastated by the Cossacks, the peasants in the steppe region around Bogucharova were, it was rumoured, in touch with the French, received leaflets from them that passed from hand to hand, and did not migrate. He learned from domestic serfs loyal to him that the peasant Karp, who possessed great influence in the village commune and had recently been away driving a government transport, had returned with news that the Cossacks were destroying deserted villages, but that the French did not harm them. Alpátych also knew that on the previous day another peasant had even brought from the village of Vizluchovo, which was occupied by the French, a proclamation by a French general that no harm would be done to the inhabitants, and if they remained they would be paid for anything taken from them. As proof of this, the peasant had brought from Vizluchovo 100 rubles in notes. He did not know that they were false, paid to him in advance for hay. More important still, Alpátych learnt that on the morning of the very day he gave the village elder orders to collect carts to move the princess's luggage from Boguchárovo, there had been a village meeting at which it had been decided not to move, but to wait. Yet there was no time to waste. On the 15th, the day of the old prince's death, the marshal had insisted on Princess Maria's leaving at once, as it was becoming dangerous. He had told her that after the 16th he could not be responsible for what might happen. On the evening of the day the old prince died, the marshal went away, promising to return next day for the funeral. But this he was unable to do, for he received tidings that the French had unexpectedly advanced and had barely time to remove his own family and valuables from his estate. For some 30 years Boguchárovo had been managed by the village elder, Dron, whom the old prince called by the diminutive Dronushka. Dron was one of those physically and mentally vigorous peasants who grow big beards as soon as they are of age and go on unchanged till they are 60 or 70, without a grey hair or the loss of a tooth, as straight and strong at 60 as at 30. Soon after the migration to the warm rivers, in which he had taken part like the rest, Dron was made village elder and overseer of Boguchárovo, and had since filled that post irreproachably for some 23 years. The peasants feared him more than they did their master. The masters, both the old prince and the young, and the steward, respected him and jestingly called him the minister. During the whole time of his service, Dron had never been drunk or ill. Never after sleepless nights or the hardest tasks had he shown the least fatigue, and though he could not read, he had never forgotten a single money account or the number of quarters of flour in any of the endless cartloads he sold for the prince, nor a single shock of the whole corn crop on any single acre of the Boguchárovo fields. Alpátych, arriving from the devastated Bald Hills estate, sent for his Dron on the day of the prince's funeral, and told him to have 12 horses got ready for the princess's carriages and 18 carts for the things to be removed from Boguchárovo. Though the peasants paid quit-rent, Alpátych thought no difficulty would be made about complying with this order, for there were 230 households at work in Boguchárovo, and the peasants were well-to-do. But on hearing the order, Dron lowered his eyes and remained silent. Alpátych named certain peasants he knew, from whom he told him to take the carts. Dron replied that the horses of these peasants were away, carting. Alpátych named others, but they too, according to Dron, had no horses available. Some horses were carting for the government, others were too weak, and others had died for want of fodder. It seemed that no horses could be had even for the carriages, much less for the carting. Alpátych looked intently at Dron and frowned. Just as Dron was a model village elder, so Alpátych had not managed the prince's estates for 20 years in vain. He, a model steward, possessing in the highest degree the faculty of divining the needs and instincts of those he dealt with. Having glanced at Dron, he at once understood that his answers did not express his personal views, but the general mood of the Boguchárovo commune, by which the elder had already been carried away. But he also knew that Dron, who had acquired property and was hated by the commune, must be hesitating between the two camps, the masters and the serfs. He noticed this hesitation in Dron's look, and therefore frowned and moved closer up to him. "Now just listen, Dronushka," said he. "Don't talk nonsense to me. His Excellency Prince Andrei himself gave me orders to move all the people away and not leave them with the enemy, and there's an order from the Tsar about it too.
Anyone who stays is a traitor to the Tsar. Do you hear?
I hear, Dron answered, without lifting his eyes.
Alpátych was not satisfied with this reply.
Eh, Dron, it will turn out badly, he said, shaking his head.
The power's in your hands, Dron rejoined sadly.
Eh, Dron, drop it,
Alpátych repeated, withdrawing his hand from his bosom and solemnly pointing to the floor at Dron's feet.
I can see through you and 3 yards into the ground under you, he continued, gazing at the floor in front of Dron.
Dron was disconcerted, glanced furtively at Alpátych, and again lowered his eyes.
You drop this nonsense, and tell the people to get ready to leave their homes and go to Moscow, and to get carts ready for tomorrow morning for the princess's things, and don't go to any meeting yourself, do you hear?
Dron suddenly fell on his knees.
Yakov Alpátych, discharge me. Take the keys from me and discharge me, for Christ's sake.
Stop that, cried Alpátych sternly. I see through you and 3 yards under you, he repeated, knowing that his skill in beekeeping, his knowledge of the right time to sow the oats, and the fact that he had been able to retain the old prince's favour for 20 years, had long since gained him the reputation of being a wizard, and that the power of seeing 3 yards under a man is considered an attribute of wizards.
Dron got up and was about to say something, but Alpátych interrupted him.
What is it you have got into your heads, eh? What are you thinking of, eh?
What am I to do with the people? Said Dron. They're quite beside themselves. I've already told them.
Told them, I dare say, said Alpátych. Are they drinking? He asked abruptly.
Quite beside themselves, Yakov Alpátych. They've fetched another barrel.
Well, then, listen. I'll go to the police officer, and you tell them so, and that they must stop this, and that the carts must be got ready.
I understand.
Alpátych did not insist further. He had managed people for a long time and knew that the chief way to make them obey is to show no suspicion that they can possibly disobey. Having wrung a submissive "I understand" from Dron, Alpátych contented himself with that, though he not only doubted but felt almost certain that without the help of troops the carts would not be forthcoming. And so it was, for when evening came, no carts had been provided. In the village, outside the drink shop, another meeting was being held, which decided that the horses should be driven out into the woods, and the carts should not be provided. Without saying anything of this to the princess, Alpátych had his own belongings taken out of the carts which had arrived from Bald Hills, and had those horses got ready for the princess's carriages. Meanwhile, he went himself to the police authorities.
Chapter 10. Princess Maria makes up her mind to leave Boguchárovo. After her father's funeral, Princess Maria shut herself up in her room and did not admit anyone. A maid came to the door to say that Alpátych was asking for orders about their departure. This was before his talk with Dron. Princess Maria raised herself on the sofa on which she had been lying, and replied through the closed door that she did not mean to go away, and begged to be left in peace. The windows of the room in which she was lying looked westward. She lay on the sofa with her face to the wall, fingering the buttons of the leather cushion, and seeing nothing but that cushion, and her confused thoughts were centred on one subject, the irrevocability of death, and her own spiritual baseness, which she had not suspected, but which had shown itself during her father's illness. She wished to pray, but did not dare to, dared not in her present state of mind address herself to God. She lay for a long time in that position. The sun had reached the other side of the house, and its slanting rays shone into the open window, lighting up the room and part of the Morocco cushion at which Princess Maria was looking. The flow of her thoughts suddenly stopped. Unconsciously she sat up, smoothed her hair, got up, and went to the window, involuntarily inhaling the freshness of the clear but windy evening.
Yes, You can well enjoy the evening now. He is gone, and no one will hinder you, she said to herself, and sinking into a chair, she let her head fall on the window-sill. Someone spoke her name in a soft and tender voice from the garden and kissed her head. She looked up. It was Mademoiselle Bourienne, in a black dress and weepers. She softly approached Princess Maria, sighed, kissed her, and immediately began to cry. The princess looked up at her. All their former disharmony and her own jealousy recurred to her mind. But she remembered, too, how he had changed of late toward Mademoiselle Bourienne, and could not bear to see her, thereby showing how unjust were the reproaches Princess Maria had mentally addressed to her. Besides, is it for me who desired his death, to condemn anyone? She thought. Princess Maria vividly pictured to herself the position of Mademoiselle Bourienne, whom she had of late kept at a distance, but who yet was dependent on her and living in her house. She felt sorry for her, and held out her hand with a glance of gentle inquiry. Mademoiselle Bourienne at once began crying again, and kissed that hand, speaking of the princess's sorrow and making herself a partner in it. She said her only consolation was the fact that the princess allowed her to share her sorrow, that all the old misunderstandings should sink into nothing but this great grief, that she felt herself blameless in regard to everyone, and that he, from above, saw her affection and gratitude. The princess heard her, not heeding her words, but occasionally looking up at her and listening to the sound of her voice.
"Your position is doubly terrible, dear princess," said Mademoiselle Bourienne after a pause. "I understand that you could not and cannot think of yourself, but with my love for you I must do so. Has Alpátych been to you? Has he spoken to you of going away?" she asked. Princess Maria did not answer. She did not understand who was to go or where to. "Is it possible to plan or think of anything now? Is it not all the same?" she thought, and did not reply. "You know, chère Marie," said Mademoiselle Bourienne, "that we are in danger, are surrounded by the French. It would be dangerous to move now. If we go, we are almost sure to be taken prisoners, and God knows."
Princess Maria looked at her companion without understanding what she was talking about.
"Oh, if anyone knew how little anything matters to me now," she said. "Of course I would on no account wish to go away from him. Alpátych did say something about going. Speak to him. I can do nothing, nothing, and don't want to."
"I've spoken to him. He hopes we should be in time to get away tomorrow, but I think it would now be better to stay here," said Mademoiselle Bourienne, "because you will agree, chère Marie, to fall into the hands of the soldiers or of riotous peasants would be terrible."
Mademoiselle Bourienne took from her reticule a proclamation, not printed on ordinary Russian paper, of General Rameau's, telling people not to leave their homes and that the French authorities would afford them proper protection. She handed this to the princess.
"I think it would be best to appeal to that general," she continued, "and I'm sure that all due respect would be shown you."
Princess Maria read the paper, and her face began to quiver with stifled sobs.
"From whom did you get this?" she asked.
"They probably recognize that I am French by my name," replied Mademoiselle Bourienne, blushing.
Princess Maria, with the paper in her hand, rose from the window and with a pale face went out of the room and into what had been Prince Andrei's study.
"Dunyasha, send Alpátych or Dronushka or somebody to me," she said, "and tell Mademoiselle Bourienne not to come to me,"
she added, hearing Mademoiselle Bourienne's voice.
"We must go at once," she said, appalled at the thought of being left in the hands of the French. "If Prince Andrei heard that I was in the power of the French, that I, the daughter of Prince Nikolai Bolkonski, asked General Rameau for protection and accepted his favour,
This idea horrified her, made her shudder, blush, and feel such a rush of anger and pride as she had never experienced before. All that was distressing, and especially all that was humiliating in her position, rose vividly to her mind.
They, the French, would settle in this house. Monsieur le Général Rameau would occupy Prince André's study and amuse himself by looking through and reading his letters and papers. Mademoiselle Bourienne would do the honours of Boguchárovo for him. I should be given a small room as a favour. The soldiers would violate my father's newly dug grave to steal his crosses and stars. They would tell me of their victories over the Russians and would pretend to sympathise with my sorrow, thought Princess Maria, not thinking her own thoughts, but feeling bound to think like her father and her brother. For herself she did not care where she remained or what happened to her, but she felt herself the representative of her dead father and of Prince Andrei. Involuntarily, she thought their thoughts and felt their feelings. What they would have said and what they would have done she felt bound to say and do. She went into Prince Andrei's study, trying to enter completely into his ideas, and considered her position. The demands of life, which had seemed to her annihilated by her father's death, all at once rose before her with a new, previously unknown force, and took possession of her. Agitated and flushed, she paced the room, sending now for Mikhail Ivanovich, and now for Tikhon or Dron. Dunyasha, the nurse, and the other maids could not say in how far Mademoiselle Bourienne's statement was correct. Alpátych was not at home. He had gone to the police. Neither could the architect, Mikhail Ivanovich, who on being sent for came in with sleepy eyes, tell Princess Maria anything. With just the same smile of agreement with which for 15 years he had been accustomed to answer the old prince without expressing views of his own, he now replied to Princess Maria, so that nothing definite could be got from his answers. The old valet, Tikhon, with sunken, emaciated face that bore the stamp of inconsolable grief, replied, "Yes, princess," to all Princess Maria's questions, and hardly refrained from sobbing as he looked at her. At length, Dron, the village elder, entered the room and, with a deep bow to Princess Maria, came to a halt by the doorpost. Princess Maria walked up and down the room and stopped in front of him.
"Dronushka," she said, regarding as a sure friend this Dronushka who always used to bring a special kind of gingerbread from his visit to the fair at Vyazma every year, and smilingly offer it to her.
"Dronushka! Now, since our misfortune—"
she began, but could not go on.
"We are all in God's hands," said he with a sigh. They were silent for a while.
"Dronushka, Alpátych has gone off somewhere, and I have no one to turn to. Is it true, as they tell me, that I can't even go away?"
"Why shouldn't you go away, Your Excellency? You can go," said Dron.
"I was told it would be dangerous because of the enemy. Dear friend, I can do nothing. I understand nothing. I have nobody. I want to go away tonight or early tomorrow morning."
Dron paused. He looked askance at Princess Maria and said,
"There are no horses. I told Yakov Alpátych so."
"Why are there none?" asked the princess.
"It's all God's scourge," said Dron. "What horses we had have been taken for the army or have died. This is such a year. It's not a case of feeding horses. We may die of hunger ourselves. As it is, some go 3 days without eating. We've nothing. We've been ruined."
Princess Maria listened attentively to what he told her.
"The peasants are ruined? They have no bread?" she asked.
"They're dying of hunger," said Dron. "It's not a case of carting."
"But why didn't you tell me, Dronushka? Isn't it possible to help them? I'll do all I can."
To Princess Maria, it was strange that now, at a moment when such sorrow was filling her soul, there could be rich people and poor, and the rich could refrain from helping the poor. She had heard vaguely that there was such a thing as landlord's corn, which was sometimes given to the peasants. She also knew that neither her father nor her brother would refuse to help the peasants in need. She only feared to make some mistake in speaking about the distribution of the grain she wished to give. She was glad such cares presented themselves, enabling her without scruple to forget her own grief. She began asking Dron about the peasants' needs and what there was in Boguchárovo that belonged to the landlord.
"But we have grain belonging to my brother," she said.
"The landlord's grain is all safe," replied Dron proudly. "Our prince did not order it to be sold."
"Give it to the peasants. Let them have all they need. I give you leave in my brother's name," said she.
Dron made no answer, but sighed deeply.
"Give them that corn, if there is enough of it. Distribute it all. I give this order in my brother's name, and tell them that what is ours is theirs. We do not grudge them anything. Tell them so."
Dron looked intently at the princess while she was speaking.
"Discharge me, little mother, for God's sake. Order the keys to be taken from me," said he. "I have served 23 years and have done no wrong. Discharge me, for God's sake."
Princess Maria did not understand what he wanted of her, or why he was asking to be discharged. She replied that she had never doubted his devotion, and that she was ready to do anything for him and for the peasants. Chapter 11. Princess Maria addresses the peasants. An hour later, Dunyasha came to tell the princess that Dron had come, and all the peasants had assembled at the barn by the princess's order and wished to have word with their mistress.
"But I never told them to come," said Princess Maria. "I only told Dron to let them have the grain." "Only for God's sake, princess dear, have them sent away and don't go out to them. It's all a trick," said Dunyasha. "And when Yakov Alpátych returns, let us get away, and please don't."
"What is a trick?" asked Princess Maria in surprise.
"I know it is. Only listen to me for God's sake. Ask nurse, too. They say they don't agree to leave Boguchárovo as you ordered."
"You're making some mistake. I never ordered them to go away," said Princess Maria. "Call Dronishka."
Dron came and confirmed Dunyasha's words. The peasants had come by the princess's order.
"But I never sent for them," declared the princess. "You must have given my message wrong. I only said that you were to give them the grain."
Dron only sighed in reply.
"If you order it, they will go away," said he.
"No, no, I'll go out to them," said Princess Maria, and in spite of the nurses' and Dunyasha's protests, she went out into the porch, Dron, Dunyasha, the nurse, and Mikhail Ivanovich following her.
"They probably think I am offering them the grain to bribe them to remain here, while I myself go away, leaving them to the mercy of the French," thought Princess Maria. "I will offer them monthly rations and housing at our Moscow estate. I'm sure Andrei would do even more in my place," she thought, as she went out in the twilight toward the crowd standing on the pasture by the barn.
The men crowded closer together, stirred, and rapidly took off their hats. Princess Maria lowered her eyes, and tripping over her skirt, came close up to them. So many different eyes, old and young, were fixed on her, and there were so many different features that she could not distinguish any of them, and feeling that she must speak to them all at once, did not know how to do it. But again, the sense that she represented her father and her brother gave her courage, and she boldly began her speech.
"I am very glad you have come,"
she said without raising her eyes, and feeling her heart beating quickly and violently.
"Dronishka tells me that the war has ruined you. That is our common misfortune, and I shall grudge nothing to help you. I am myself going away, because it is dangerous here. The enemy is near. Because I am giving you everything, my friends, and I beg you to take everything, all our grain, so that you may not suffer want. And if you have been told that I am giving you the grain to keep you here, that is not true.
On the contrary, I ask you to go with all your belongings to our estate near Moscow, and I promise you I will see to it that there you shall want for nothing. You shall be given food and lodging.
The princess stopped. Sighs were the only sound heard in the crowd.
I am not doing this on my own account, she continued. I do it in the name of my dead father, who was a good master to you, and of my brother and his son.
Again she paused. No one broke the silence.
Ours is a common misfortune, and we will share it together. All that is mine is yours, she concluded, scanning the faces before her.
All eyes were gazing at her with one and the same expression. She could not fathom whether it was curiosity, devotion, gratitude, or apprehension and distrust. But the expression on all the faces was identical.
"We are all very thankful for your bounty, but it won't do for us to take the landlord's grain," said a voice at the back of the crowd.
"But why not?" asked the princess.
No one replied, and Princess Maria, looking round at the crowd, found that every eye she met now was immediately dropped.
"But why don't you want to take it?" she asked again.
No one answered. The silence began to oppress the princess, and she tried to catch someone's eye.
"Why don't you speak?"
she inquired of a very old man who stood just in front of her, leaning on his stick.
"If you think something more is wanted, tell me. I will do anything," said she, catching his eye.
But as if this angered him, he bent his head quite low and muttered,
"Why should we agree? We don't want the grain."
"Why should we give up everything? We don't agree."
"Don't agree.
We're sorry for you, but we're not willing."
"Go away yourself, alone,"
came from various sides of the crowd. And again, all the faces in the crowd bore an identical expression, though now it was certainly not an expression of curiosity or gratitude, but of angry resolve.
"But you can't have understood me," said Princess Maria with a sad smile. "Why don't you want to go? I promised to house and feed you, while here the enemy would ruin you."
But her voice was drowned by the voices of the crowd.
"We're not willing. Let them ruin us. We won't take your grain. We don't agree."
And again Princess Maria tried to catch someone's eye, but not a single eye in the crowd was turned to her. Evidently they were all trying to avoid her look. She felt strange and awkward.
"Oh, yes, an artful tale, follower into slavery.
Pull down your houses and go into bondage, I dare say."
"I'll give you grain, indeed," she says,
voices in the crowd were heard saying. With drooping head, Princess Maria left the crowd and went back to the house. Having repeated her order to Dron to have horses ready for her departure next morning, she went to her room and remained alone with her own thoughts.
Chapter 12. Princess Maria remembers her father. For a long time that night, Princess Maria sat by the open window of her room, hearing the sound of the peasants' voices that reached her from the village. But it was not of them she was thinking. She felt that she could not understand them, however much she might think about them. She thought only of one thing, her sorrow, which, after the break caused by cares for the present, seemed already to belong to the past. Now she could remember it and weep or pray. After sunset the wind had dropped. The night was calm and fresh. Toward midnight the voices began to subside. A cock crowed. The full moon began to show from behind the lime trees. A fresh, white, dewy mist began to rise, and stillness reigned over the village and the house. Pictures of the near past, her father's illness and last moments, rose one after another to her memory. With mournful pleasure she now lingered over those images, repelling with horror only the last one, the picture of his death, which she felt she could not contemplate even in imagination at this still and mystic hour of night. And these pictures presented themselves to her so clearly and in such detail that they seemed now present, now past, and now future.
She vividly recalled the moment when he had his first stroke and was being dragged along by his armpits through the garden at Bald Hills, muttering something with his helpless tongue, twitching his grey eyebrows and looking uneasily and timidly at her.
"Even then he wanted to tell me what he told me the day he died," she thought. "He had always thought what he said then."
And she recalled in all its detail the night at Bald Hills before he had the last stroke, when, with a foreboding of disaster, she had remained at home against his will. She had not slept, and had stolen downstairs on tiptoe, and going to the door of the conservatory where he slept that night, had listened at the door. In a suffering and weary voice, he was saying something to Tichon, speaking of the Crimea and its warm nights and of the Empress. Evidently he had wanted to talk.
"And why didn't he call me? Why didn't he let me be there instead of Tichon?"
Princess Maria had thought, and thought again now.
"Now he will never tell anyone what he had in his soul. Never will that moment return for him or for me, when he might have said all he longed to say, and not Tichon, but I might have heard and understood him. Why didn't I enter the room?" she thought. "Perhaps he would then have said to me what he said the day he died. While talking to Tichon, he asked about me twice. He wanted to see me, and I was standing close by outside the door." It was sad and painful for him to talk to Tichon, who did not understand him. I remember how he began speaking to him about Lisa, as if she were alive. He had forgotten she was dead. And Tichon reminded him that she was no more, and he shouted, "Fool!" He was greatly depressed. From behind the door I heard how he lay down on his bed groaning and loudly exclaimed, "My God! Why didn't I go in then? What could he have done to me? What could I have lost? And perhaps he would then have been comforted and would have said that word to me."
And Princess Maria uttered aloud the caressing word he had said to her on the day of his death.
"Dearest," she repeated, and began sobbing, with tears that relieved her soul.
She now saw his face before her, and not the face she had known ever since she could remember, and had always seen at a distance, but the timid, feeble face she had seen for the first time quite closely, with all its wrinkles and details, when she stooped near to his mouth to catch what he said.
"Dearest," she repeated again. What was he thinking when he uttered that word? What is he thinking now?
This question suddenly presented itself to her, and in answer she saw him before her, with the expression that was on his face as he lay in his coffin, with his chin bound up with a white handkerchief, and the horror that had seized her when she touched him and convinced herself that that was not he, but something mysterious and horrible, seized her again. She tried to think of something else and to pray, but could do neither. With wide-open eyes, she gazed at the moonlight and the shadows, expecting every moment to see his dead face, and she felt that the silence brooding over the house and within it held her fast.
"Dunyasha," she whispered.
"Dunyasha!"
She screamed wildly, and tearing herself out of this silence, she ran to the servants' quarters to meet her old nurse and the maidservants who came running toward her. Chapter 13. Nikolai and Ilyin ride to Boguchárovo. On the 17th of August, Rostov and Ilyin, accompanied by Lavrushka, who had just returned from captivity, and by an hussar orderly, left their quarters at Yankovo, 10 miles from Boguchárovo, and went for a ride, to try a new horse Ilyin had bought, and to find out whether there was any hay to be had in the villages. For the last 3 days Boguchárovo had lain between the two hostile armies, so that it was as easy for the Russian rearguard to get to it as for the French vanguard. Rostov, as a careful squadron commander, wished to take such provisions as remained at Boguchárovo before the French could get them. Rostov and Ilyin were in the merriest of moods. On the way to Bogucharova, a princely estate with a dwelling house and farm where they hoped to find many domestic serfs and pretty girls, they questioned Lavrushka about Napoleon and laughed at his stories and raced one another to try Ilyin's horse. Rostov had no idea that the village he was entering was the property of that very Bolkonsky who had been engaged to his sister. Rostov and Ilyin gave rein to their horses.